Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's October 29th, 2012, speaking to you from the city that is the home to the winners of the World Series this year. They swept the Detroit Tigers in just four games. Congratulations to the Giants.
Baseball season's here. I know my baby's disappeared to see the Giants down in Candlestick.
Well, it's AT&T now.
I need a season pass if I want our love to last, and I better do it mighty quick. Because you took this blood and green and my baseball glove. I can see her on that first base side. Just having a ball and arguing every call. And I know what I'm going to hear tonight. She'll say, I want to see the Giants win. I want to see the Giants win. Take me to the stick. Take me to the stick. I want to see the Giants win.
Well, we saw them win. In just four games, and it was it's just been real exciting. And you probably have figured out that I am not the world's biggest sports fan, and I do follow the Giants, particularly when they get into postseason play. And it's a thrill to share that community spirit, and especially when they were so effective in just four games. But, of course, it leads to all this homer coverage, and just a little whining here Sunday night. After the game had been broadcast on Channel 2, I was tuning into their 10 o'clock news, which is arguably the best commercial TV news operation in the Bay Area, and I wanted to get an update on Hurricane Sandy and its threats to the East Coast. But all we got was all these live shots from the Civic Center, where people had been watching outdoors on a big screen, and also from various bars around the city. And it was the same kind of incoherent ramble coming from excited and exhilarated fans. And frankly, the Channel 2 News hour-long show appeared to be about 48 minutes of that kind of coverage. And of course, Channel 2 had carried the game, a lengthy post-game show, and frankly, it was overkill. But hey, you know, it only happens here. Two out of every 3 years. And I'm sure that's hard for a lot of sports fans in other cities to take. So enough of that. We are today focused in our new in-depth interview released at peterbcollins.com with Brad Friedman, the citizen journalist blogger at bradblog.com, who provides the most comprehensive coverage of election issues and the threats to an honest election looming for next Tuesday, November 6th. And we talk about quite a bit in the interview, including a very interesting piece that is flying around the internet right now that was published in Britain based on the work of a retired American spook from the National Security Agency who is based in Arizona and who has done a painstaking statistical analysis. And he argues from those numbers that Mitt Romney and his allies are capable of flipping votes to Mitt Romney, either from Republicans in the primary or from Democrats in this general election season. And it's interesting to see the numbers, but let's get a reality check. Here's an excerpt from my interview with Brad Friedman.
Those studies may or may not be right. I can't confirm them one way or another because I'm not a statistician. I've seen a lot of studies put out there that suddenly you find one variable that they had incorrect and it changes the entire outlook.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I can't really speak to that study. It's also unclear if, in fact, they are right in their thesis that somehow or another Romney does better in these large precincts. You know, the charge is that somehow they're gaming the electronic system to make that happen. I'm not clear on what the mechanism would be to accomplish that. If they're saying that somehow there's a complicated formula that is being put into the electronic tabulators, okay, what's that formula? How is it put in? And do we have any, you know, actual evidence that it has been put in? That's what I would look for. So
they do speculate about, and because it was printed in Britain, it has more credibility because they talk about a computer program spelled P-R-O-G-R-A-M-M-E.
Yeah, that's right.
And, of course, that gives you a stiff upper lip, and you immediately know that it's accurate. And I hope you'll listen to the full interview with Brad Friedman at peterbcollins.com. If you're not a subscriber, a buck will get you a 24-hour pass, and you can grab the interview. The juiciest part is when he talks about his email back and forth with Judd Legum at the Think Progress blog of the Center for American Progress, which took some very unfair swipes at Brad and some other people related to the legitimate story that allies of Mitt Romney, including people who worked with him at Bain Capital, have taken financial control of one of the electronic voting machines, Hart InterCivic, and three people who sit on the Hart InterCivic board either worked at Bain or are big fundraisers for Mitt Romney. It's a legitimate story, but presumable allies at Think Progress took some very unfair hits and called Brad a conspiracy theorist. And you've got to listen to his description of it and then go to Brad's blog and read the parody that he wrote about Think Progress based on the same kind of false accusation of conspiracy theories. Today we take a look at Mitt Romney, and I'll be candid that over the course of this campaign, I have not brought you blow-by-blow daily coverage of each campaign stop. There's plenty of coverage of that, and I try to fill in the gaps in media here and cover things that don't normally surface. So item one here is a fascinating article from the October 22nd edition of Newsweek, which is about to be euthanized as a print publication. But they ran a lengthy article of commentary from David Stockman. And if you're as old as I am, or maybe not quite, you'll remember that he was Ronald Reagan's budget director. And he has been out of step, politically incorrect as a Republican at many stages of his life. And the latest outburst from him is a must-read, because he admits that he himself is a vulture capitalist, that since he left government, he has been running these kind of turnaround funds, and so he really knows how vulture capitalism works. And he makes a number of stunning statements, including saying this: the modus operandi of the leverage buyout business, and in a free market economy, there wouldn't be much scope for it because it creates little of economic value. But we have a rigged system, he says, a regime of crony capitalism where the tax code heavily favors debt and capital gains, and the central bank purposefully enables rampant speculation by propping up the price of financial assets and battering down the cost of leveraged finance. So the vast outpouring of LBOs, leverage buyouts, in recent decades has been the consequence of bad policy, not the product of capitalist enterprise. Stockman: I know this from 17 years of experience doing leverage buyouts at one of the pioneering private equity houses, Blackstone, and then my own firm. I know the pitfalls of private equity. I mean, this is stunningly honest. And he analyzes some of the Bain deals that Mitt Romney was involved with. And let me just pick one here. He says the most emblematic among these deals was a roll-up deal focused on down-in-the-mouth department stores and apparel chains that were falling by the wayside in small-town America due to the arrival of Walmart and the big-box retailers. Here's an example. Bain invested $10 million in 1988 and later took out 18 times its money, that is, $175 million in profit. It was one of the last deals underwritten by Drexel Milken, the junk bond machine, and it ultimately went under, and it paid back none of the Milken debt. It was underperforming, earning about only $14 million a year, exactly what it had generated in 1992 on half the number of stores. So what he basically points out is what has been kind of underscored in some of the negative ads from the Obama campaign and its super PAC friends, which is that the MO of Bain is they put in a small amount of money, they load up the company with debt, they extract huge fees from them for themselves, and then they walk away from it. And more often than not, that leads to a company that runs bankrupt, and it's the little people, the employees, and some outside shareholders who get hurt the most. Now, in my email over the weekend, I got a link to a very interesting video, and I'm going to put it up for you at peterbcollins.com. It comes from Jeff Zeiser in Portland, Oregon.
Don't play that song, that achy-breaky song, the most annoying song I know. And if you play that song, that achy-breaky song, I might blow up my radio.
Now, that's Weird Al, but Jeff Zeiser does a takeoff of the achy-breaky song, and it's based on the Etch-a-Sketch comment from one of Mitt Romney's campaign officials. And it is an accurate portrayal of Mitt Romney, sung by Jeff. He's not quite as good as Al Yankovic, but he is spirited in his delivery. And so click on the link in the show file at peterbcollins.com, and you can experience this for yourself. Meanwhile, the New York Times makes the case as to why Mitt Romney should not be elected in its full-page editorial endorsement of Barack Obama. Now, as you know, I won't be voting for Obama. I have the luxury here in a solid blue state of casting a protest vote, and I will for the Justice Party candidate, Rocky Anderson. You may not be in that position, and so this is one of those things I say don't do at home if your home is a purple state or one that is, you know, somewhere right on the brink. But they basically nail Mitt Romney up and down. Quote, Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts, has gotten this far with a guile that allows him to say whatever he thinks an audience wants to hear. But he has tied himself to the ultra-conservative forces that control the Republican Party and embrace their policies, including reckless budget cuts and 30-year-old discredited trickle-down ideas. Voters may still be confused about Mr. Romney's true identity, but they know the Republican Party, and a Romney administration would reflect its agenda. Romney's choice of Paul Ryan as his running mate says volumes about that. Later, on health care, Mr. Romney has no plan for covering the uninsured beyond his callous assumption that they will use emergency rooms. He wants to use voucher programs to shift more Medicare costs to beneficiaries and block grants to shift more Medicaid costs to the states. On the economy, Romney's economic plan, as much as we know about it, is regressive, relying on big tax cuts and deregulation. That kind of plan was not the answer after the financial crisis and will not create broad prosperity. And so it's a good critique of Romney. I don't embrace all of its praise of Barack Obama, but that's what we get in the two-party system in this country. Also in Sunday's New York Times, two very strong op-eds. First, I'll mention Nicholas Kristof, who talks about Todd Akin and more recently Richard Murdoch, both candidates for the Senate from Missouri and Indiana, respectively, and both of whom have gone off the deep end trying to prove their true red credentials as pro-lifers. And these are the guys who talk about rape in such a callous way. And Kristof, to his credit, says if you want to be outraged, then take a look at the pattern across the country, that when a woman is raped, there is what's called a rape kit. They take swabs of DNA, and they extract whatever deposits the rapist has made in this victim's body. But testing that DNA costs about $1,200. And many of these rape kits often sit untested for years in police storage rooms. And in some cases, the victim is required to pay $1,200 or more to get this tested because law enforcement doesn't have apparently the interest or the money to test every rape kit. And if there's no evidence, then it's very hard to prosecute that rapist, and that rapist remains at large. And this is a much more serious issue than the pandering to religious fundamentalists, Catholics, and evangelical Christians in this country to claim that these Republicans are going to change the Supreme Court decision that protects a woman's right to choose. Now, I do understand that if Romney becomes president and the Republicans control the Senate, they can put pro-lifers on the Supreme Court. And Justice Kennedy remains the swing vote on this issue. So it really is on a teeter-totter And so we really need Democrats to be more courageous in expressing our outrage about these Republican statements that minimize rape, say that it's God's will, and therefore if a woman is raped, she should just carry that baby because that's what God wanted. And I just think that is fundamentally twisted. It's an insult to any notion of God that I'm aware of. And it's something that everyone should be outraged about. And when we see the polls showing that women are swinging away from Obama and toward Romney, despite these important issues, it really scares the living shit out of me. That's all I can say. And Tom Friedman has a column that took my breath away when I read the headline. It's captioned, "Why I Am Pro-Life." I said, oh, here we go now. But he does a great job of using that misleading headline to get you to read his column. He says, in my world, you don't get to call yourself pro-life and be against common sense gun control, like banning public access to semi-automatic weapons. You don't get to call yourself pro-life and want to shut down the Environmental Protection Agency. You don't get to call yourself pro-life and oppose programs like Head Start that provide basic education, health, and nutrition for the most disadvantaged children. You can call yourself a pro-conception-to-birth, indifferent-to-life conservative. Well, good for you. I often disagree with Friedman. I think he's a globalist and a corporatist. But on this particular article or commentary that he wrote, I give him high marks. And one more pick from the Gray Lady, the New York Times, in Monday's editorial page. It does a good job of identifying an issue that I have ranted about here for years, and that is the undermining of our Fourth Amendment constitutional right to be free from surveillance without probable cause and a court order. And this relates to the widespread wiretapping of Americans' domestic communications, phone calls, emails, etc. And there is a suit before the Supreme Court related to the FISA amendments of 2008, and I'll remind you that Senator Obama said he was against it, and then after he safely secured the nomination, he voted for it, and he has worked to extend these unconstitutional police state measures as he has become president and had almost 4 years in office now. And this is one of the fundamental reasons why I cannot bring myself to vote for Barack Obama for a second term. And one of the issues that we've discussed at length with the lawyer for the Al Haramain charity case, John Eisenberg, that originated here in the Bay Area, that produced a verdict in favor of the plaintiffs who could prove that they had been wiretapped and therefore that they had, quote-unquote, standing before the court. And the case before the Supreme Court right now is narrowly framed around the standing issue. But if they find that you cannot sue over wiretapping unless you can actually prove that you were wiretapped, that is a loophole bigger than 18 Mack trucks, and it will enable the government and the phone companies to perpetually, maybe permanently, dodge any accountability for the clear violations of our Fourth Amendment rights. We're watching carefully all across the country the progress of Hurricane Sandy as it moves up the East Coast, and if you're listening there, your power is still on, you're hunkered down at home, I hope you remain safe and that Sandy does not make a negative invasion of your world. Want you to know, though, that over the weekend, the West Coast had to prepare for a tsunami after a 7.7 Richter scale earthquake hit off the coast of Western Canada. It was on Saturday evening. I want to give a thumbs up and a shout out to my friend Tom Seaborn in the tsunami-vulnerable city of Eureka, California. It's up along the north coast, just shy of the Oregon border. And he posted on Facebook the first news that I saw of this earthquake. And fortunately, the waves created by the earthquake were not significant, and there was no reported damage either in California or Hawaii. And finally, today in China, there have been protests that turned violent, and the protesters say it was the police who amped up into violence. But there are also reports that the protesters attacked police cars and threw bricks and water bottles at cops. At any rate, They were protesting, the activists were, the expansion of a state-run chemical plant called Sinopec. It's already one of the nation's largest refineries, and local residents citing environmental concerns have been demanding that the government move the plant from Ningbo, a prosperous city of more than 3 million in Zhejiang province, not far from Shanghai. And in news released today, it appears that the government is least posing to responding to this protest, and at least temporarily they're going to halt this construction. Given the Chinese autocratic government and the wealth of the leadership that was exposed last week by the New York Times, I don't think that we'll see much difference between the Chinese government and the way we kowtow to the coal industry and the oil refineries and the offshore oil drilling that occurs in and around the United States. But it is a hopeful moment coming from China. Thanks for joining me for my rants and raves here, news and comment. You are free to share this free podcast with anyone you know. Thanks.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.